welcome to the Good Writing Podcast.
In this episode, we talk about The Book of X by Sarah Rose Eder, and specifically her use of interspersing just lists of facts throughout her novel. Just pausing the novel, dropping some facts, resuming the novel throughout.
Yes. Yeah, we talk about those facts, the way that they convey that narrative, the way they enhance that narrative, and also the way that facts are, you know, it sounds simple to say it, but the way that they inform the basis of how we think about kind of everything that we do and say, and how useful that is to consider when you're writing.
Yes, and it can be used to explore character, explore concept, create a little pause, have a little breaky boo. Little coffee break, little facts break, and then go back on it.
Dip your cookie in some facts, and then get back in that novel.
Enjoy the episode. Ben Kearns, how the heck are you?
I'm doing good, Emily Donovan. I'm doing very good. It's good to see you here. It's good to be back on the pod once again. It's time for some very good writing, very exciting stuff. Really stoked. How are you doing?
Back to the Good Writing Podcast. I'm doing really well. It has been... Never mind. Let's just stop acknowledging when we take six-month gaps. What do you think?
It's unimportant. It's unimportant because, like, as far as I'm concerned, the Good Writing Podcast ends when one of us dies. I'm not, like, that is when it truly ends. It might be 3 years between episodes at one point. Like, who knows? But this will not be over, and barring, you know, our continued livelihood, as far as I'm concerned.
Or if every writing becomes bad. But I'm pretty sure we'll always think some writing is, at least in context, comparatively good.
That's true. And also, because we're not limited to new things, we do allow ourselves to go back into the past. We do have the entire backlog of things people have written up until now, even if all writing does become objectively bad.
Which seems to be a lot of writing. I've started looking into it. The year is 2024, and I think there was a lot written before this year.
I've been examining the corpus of available text, and it turns out there's a lot.
Written things. Gutenberg Press, have you heard about it? Things just took off after that.
They did that. There was plenty when they just had the vellum, but man, when Gutenberg started smashing those letters, we really made asses of ourselves with the amount of writing we've been doing.
Just out the wazoo. Just a barrel full. Absolutely barrel full of text to draw upon.
Oh, man.
Ben, since we last recorded, Magazine One's first issue came out, and I just want to say on the air, I'm so happy for you, dude. That's huge.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. And also thank you to everyone that has read that. I know that people listening have read the magazine. I know that for a fact. I really appreciate all of that, because it just means a lot to make a thing and to have it be acknowledged in that way. People had a lot of really nice reactions and a lot of kind words from the contributors and from people who had just read it. I feel really proud of it, and I feel really proud of all the people that I got to publish in there.
As you should. You had a really cool, diverse array of, like, how much experience writers had, too, and style and... Mm-hmm. Some of it was weird in a way that was, like, so Ben Kearns, and some of it was, like, I think, pushing your taste, too, and I, it's a really strong lit mag, and I'm really happy for you. And it's huge that you put a new home for writing out into the world. That's so huge. You're out there doing the work, friend.
Thank you. That's the hope. It's just to make more space for more interesting things. Because that's all I wanted. I'm glad that you say that it felt that I pushed my own taste in that too. Because I was trying to do that, to try to reach outside of the boundaries that I, you know, have of my own interests, and make sure that I was really trying to think about, like, what, as we do here, like, what's really good writing. Like, what makes that up? And it's not just things I like. There's a lot of things that make good writing good, and that could be represented a lot of different ways, and I think that the stuff that we got to showcase really showcased that as well.
I'm so happy for you. And so for anyone just listening, tuning in now for the first time, Magazine One is published through the bookstore where Ben works, Bookstore One, based in Sarasota, Florida. And Magazine-One is accepting for issue 2? Are you going to call it Magazine Dash 2?
No, it is Magazine 1, issue 2. There are parts of me that want to do a lot of really shitty things with the fact that we are called Magazine 1. Including doing things like making Magazine 1, issue 2, issue 1. So, like, doing subsets, things like that. Making really confusing trees. So to just add additional numerals at the end, maybe trying to do something with binary code to say something incredibly stupid. It's hard to resist.
You know, Ben, I think your real magic touch, the je ne sais quoi that you bring to your literary projects, is a complete lack of respect for search engine optimization.
Oh, yeah, baby. We could not care less about that. Search is dead anyways. It's all AI generated now. There's no more SEO. There's just pure garbage. Do whatever you want.
Do whatever you want. This man is undiscoverable online, just about. His magazine is Magazine One. His podcast is The Good Writing Podcast. These are descriptions, not names.
Yep. Man, what? People are going to search for the Sarasota Review? No, they aren't. No one wants to read that. It's Magazine One, baby.
That's a point. Yeah. The review is also kind of vague. Overdone.
Okay, so real question. Do you know why they, like, magazines will call themselves The Review? Like, is it just in reference to, like, because they at one time or still do put reviews in there? Or is it something else? Like,
my face, I know we're an audio platform. My face fell as Ben asked that question. I don't know if you can see that in the video call. I have no idea.
Yeah, no,
I forgot about book reviews as, like, a name, as an origin, actually. Let's Google this now. Why Lit Mag's named Review? Did you know? No. Oh, that's... Sorry. An AI-generated summary did not make any sense when I just Googled that.
Exactly, as I said. Yeah.
You know what? I think you're onto something not being search engine optimized.
It's nothing, yeah.
That feels like Bartleby the Scrivener level of just, like, personal protest. Like, I'd prefer not to be found online, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, I tried Googling that question and I don't have an answer for you because I did not understand or comprehend the summary that AI generated for us on that subject.
That's fine. Maybe it's because it's like you hear about places called like the Southern Review or the Georgia Review. Maybe it's like meant to be like a review of what's happening in that area when lit magazines were more localized in that way kind of thing. Like,
yeah,
so
but
it's
they're
like,
really not localized now. Like, yeah, they're exactly. Really, really not localized.
Yeah, there's no such thing as a local magazine. I mean, I guess there can be still. You can just accept from small areas, but things like that just aren't a thing anymore, yeah.
It's hard to find. Hard to find. Well, what we used to do on this show. Yes. How has writing been for you?
Okay. Having a full-time job now, like, my job is full-time, and the manager of the store, I have not been writing very much lately, I will say that. But I have, in lieu of that, I take my journal with me everywhere, and I do a little bit of journaling, and recently I completed an entire write-through. I'm not even comfortable calling it a draft yet. Like, I don't think that it's a full draft of a story yet, but it is a complete, like, beginning, middle, and end of a concept that I have written out by hand in there, which has been very interesting. Like, and I found the act of writing by hand to be very freeing. Like, it's something that I think I was resistant to before. I think we've discussed this on the podcast, even, of having a hard time with, like, my having a hard time doing that sort of thing. But I have done that. And it's a place where it's very easy for me to, like, be okay with writing things that are bad. Like, you know, they always talk about the shitty first draft and all that. And I really do think that fully has kind of, like, freed me from any worry I have of something not looking the way I want it to, because it feels so much more official when I'm typing it out on the computer, is what I realize. But when I'm writing it in my already bad handwriting, then there's nothing. Then I have nothing to fear. Like, there's no way that it's going to be good, bad, the other, like, I can just let it write. Like, yeah.
Mm. I also think if your handwriting is harder to read, mm-hmm. no one will find out if your draft is bad. Like, no one's going to put mm-hmm. the effort in of, like, mm-hmm. decrypting your handwriting in order to read mm-hmm. a short story that hardly even is coherent anyway. So, yeah. like, if I sometimes think about, you know, when I read, like, archives or hear about, like, unpublished letters of writers mm-hmm. from the past, and I think sometimes about, like, oh god, if somebody discovered my, like, journal I keep for mental health purposes, I will seem fucking mm-hmm. insane. Like, I hope mm-hmm. I never get so famous that anyone is interested in this. I'll need to burn it if I do. But, like, no, actually, no one's gonna decrypt my cursive. Like, that's not gonna happen. Like, nothing in there is that juicy. What are we talking about? Yeah.
No, I get it. I get it 100%. But, yeah. But how about you? How's writing been going?
Pretty good. So, as I mentioned in an earlier episode, I got laid off, and I finally accepted a job. I'm in a little bit of a limbo period, enjoying some time off before my new start date. But I've had quite a lot of available time during this layoff. And yeah, I took a poetry workshop, which I've loved, mm-hmm. and have been dabbling in poetry and found that to be really good for me as a writer. Like, they're so mm-hmm. efficient. Mm-hmm. The workshop is with a poet who you might know as a slam poet, Desiree Dalla Giacomo, mm-hmm. who is just like one of... It's a generative workshop, and I've never done I didn't do poetry in our MFA, and I've just freaking loved this. I think she's a phenomenal facilitator. I will say, I hope they don't listen to this podcast, but one thing that I've learned about poets from this poetry workshop is, like, they're mm-hmm. just a lot more in touch with themselves than I historically mm-hmm. am, or than our fiction writer friends mm-hmm. generally
that's
are.
That's a nice thing to say, though. Yeah, that's a sweet thing to say, though. Yeah.
They're so in touch with themselves, and yeah. most of the time somebody weeps on camera during the Zoom workshop.
Wow.
which is just, like, really fast. And then they read this poetry that we, like, generated during class, and it's just, like, so fucking vulnerable, and it gets to something really meaty so efficiently. And there's just so much to learn from dabbling in other forms. So I've been having a ton of fun with that.
That's awesome. Like, so are you producing slam right now, or are you doing, like, what kind of poetry do you think you're making? Yeah.
Me shaking my head vigorously. No, I'm not much of a performer. But yeah, just been doing a little writey writes, and I think it's been really helpful for me to poets just even, like, the more humble fiction and nonfiction writers are still planning to be published. Like, that is part mm-hmm. of their plan. But many of these poets are incredibly talented, and their plan is to post it on their personal social media. Like, they're mm-hmm. like, the publishing cycle is just, like, not top of mind for them, and it doesn't need to be, because even famous poetry books generally don't make money. Yeah, it's been a really healthy, like, reset about, like, thinking about the words as art rather than, like, having any weight of commercial publishing industry.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what do you think you're gleaning out of this? Like, well, what's some takeaways that you found in the poetry that you're writing, like, that feels, like, internalized? Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. Good question. I think, like, the efficiency of to get to the concept and then to leave it on, like, a one-page poem rather than... You know, I've done short stories where I feel like I finally discover the concept on page 16 and mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. to really need to know what you're writing about and then write directly into it. I feel like I've in the past, a younger me has done a lot of, like, slant writing or writing towards a topic rather than directly mm-hmm. into the thick of it. I've been, you know, thinking I have to be coy rather mm-hmm. than being able to just, like, go directly into saying whatever thing I want to be writing about. That's been really valuable. Something else I've been thinking about, I think, like, modern poetry generally is not that strict about form. Like, most poems mm-hmm. today don't rhyme, for example. Most poems today are not really paying attention to, like, feet or meter. And I think that that's been interesting for me too, like, to be more formally experimental and thinking about like what's something looks on the page without necessarily like doing a syllable count or like worrying about feet for the sake of worrying about feet has been really enlightening for me and helped me think more about like, well, what aesthetic on the page would drive home my fucking point rather than like, I have to fulfill, a short story has to be this many, at least this many words or under this many words or else it won't get published. That's been really valuable. Sorry if I'm rambling here. Oh, and then Voltas. Like, some phenomenal poems, just like, you know, 3/4 of the way through the poem, like you thought you knew what this poem was about, and then the volta or like the change happens where you realize, oh, this poem is actually about his dead grandma or whatever. I think that's been really valuable because like it's been a valuable experiment in like how long should you lead the reader along before you really reveal what the heart of what you're talking about is, or like are both perspectives on the topic like before the volta and after the volta like both valid and worth exploring separate, like, I don't know, sorry, that wasn't the most articulate.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense, because I was just asking for like what are some things, and those are definitely some things that are just like, you know, I see them being universally like, you know, useful to you in writing, not just in poetry but just in writing itself. And I especially that first one of just like, I relate to that a lot, the whole like slanting towards an idea, like, or like running sidelong to it without actually touching it for desire to be coy, or in some cases like not even trying to be coy but being coy because I don't know what the answer is, like I don't actually know what I'm trying to say, I just know there's something there, I don't know what it is yet, like,
like, that's like really useful. I think it's a really classic MFA fiction style, you know, like Raymond Carver style. It feels very, also my personal background, but it feels very Midwestern to me too, to just like write slantly towards something rather than ever just saying it fucking out loud. I think like historically that's been really rewarded as intelligent writing, like where, oh, you as the reader have to, you know, oh, she's pregnant, this is a, they're fighting because actually they're really, what they're really talking about, although it's not on the page, is she should, is she going to get an abortion or whatever, topic that isn't on the page. And like, that can be fun for a reader, but that's not the only kind of fun there is. And what if we just said the topic so that we could have a real conversation about it sometimes?
I think that's incredibly useful. That's a really good point, especially because like you say, like, it's interesting to use the term intelligent writing too, because right, it's like, that kind of writing is, it's writing that makes the reader feel smart, right? Like, because it's like, you know, like you said, like, oh, figuring out that the Hills Like White Elephants, which is the story that I think you were referring to with the whole abortion thing, like, right? Like, that it's actually about an abortion. That's what they're mad about. Like, yeah, it's when you figure that out, you as the reader are the smart one, when it's like, that's not necessarily even a quality of the writing. It's just a, like, if the subject matter is being danced around or not.
It's a game. That's, Hills Like White Elephants, that's Ernest Hemingway, right?
Yeah, isn't that
that's what we're both thinking of?
I'm thinking of Hemingway.
Exactly. Like, is that actually, I don't know, there is an art to trusting your reader. I think it can be called for sometimes, but, I also think sometimes you can, I think like, oh, this abortion in that example is taboo, is like not that interesting of a fucking point. Like, you know, like, just, sorry, I keep swearing today, but just like get the topic out there and then actually make a, explore it more deeply rather than being afraid to look it head on.
Yeah, because then the opportunity for subtlety is also like enhanced, right? Like when you suddenly no longer have to have your central theme be referred to in subtle ways, you're now you can enter the realm of nuance in the discussion on that thing, right? Like if you're talking about it directly, you're then given that freedom in your discourse.
That's what I've been thinking about.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm so glad. I'm glad that you've been doing this poetry workshop. Is it still ongoing, or are you like, is it just like an ongoing thing? Like,
it's permanently ongoing. I think it's been ongoing for like 3 or 4 years. A friend of mine, a poet here in Denver named Cody Vesley, recommended it to me.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, she's still accepting people. If you, cool. I feel very humbled because I don't have a formal poetry background. But if you are interested in an ongoing workshop, Undercurrents with Desiree Della Giacomo, give that a Google. She's got slots still. Yeah. It's Fridays. Oh, wow. Every Friday.
Okay. Is it paid or not paid?
It's really relatively, I mean, it's relatively cheap for what okay. It's like $50 a month for every Friday.
Okay. Cool. Which like, is yeah, I'm just wondering for the listeners' sake too. Like, yeah, if they're new, well, what the entry is. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Recommend.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, on the topic of recommend, what is this book that you have recommended to me that I now like that I'm going to be buying because it's cool. It's a cool book.
He already likes it. All right, yeah. Y'all. Welcome to this week's episode of the Good Writing Podcast. This week we are talking about The Book of X, a novel. It is by Sarah Rose Etter, put out by $2 Radio, the indie press based in Columbus, Ohio, in 2019. $2 Radio may be familiar to you because
$2 Radio supremacy.
What the heck? Ben has a $2 Radio tattoo.
Have a $2 Radio tattoo. Like, yeah. What? That was my first tattoo. Yeah. $2 Radio supremacy.
Oh my God, it's on his neck.
Yeah.
Why do you have a $2 Radio tattoo?
Because $2 Radio, when I was put out a bunch of really interesting books in like 2014, 2015, they still do. But like basically right around the time I was graduating college and I had very little money. And they have a thing called the $2 Radio Tattoo Club where they send you 10 books if you get a tattoo of their logo. And it was cheaper for me to go to a shitty tattoo shop and get a tattoo of the logo on my body than to buy 10 books. So that's what I did. Like, and I will never regret that. Yeah.
My mind is blown. Did you love the 10 books?
I love some of them. Some of them I still haven't read and still have on my shelf. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And this was your first ever tattoo?
As my first ever tattoo, yeah.
Wow. You know about libraries, right?
Yeah, I mean, sure, but isn't this cooler?
Touché. Touché. Oh my gosh, yeah. This is so funny. I've known you for 7 years?
Yeah.
And I have no idea.
Yeah.
It's so fun to continue to discover new facts.
Yeah.
That's stunning. I love that. Wow. I know $2 Radio because they published Hanif Abdurraqib's essay collection.
Yeah, great collection. Yeah.
Which is phenomenal. They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us is one of my favorite books.
Yeah.
Wow, you have a $2 Radio tattoo. I'm sorry, I can't continue with the episode. Woman was too stunned to speak.
No, big fan of Rudolf Wurlitzer's novels that they have on there. They reprinted those, which is really interesting. Big fan of The Visiting Suit, great memoir collection of essays about being in a Maoist prison camp that they put out. Really good stuff from The Absolution of Roberto Acetis Lang, a really great like horror-adjacent novel. That's really good. What was their vampire novel that I read called? Something about like oranges that's also very good. I can't remember that one, but really cool. Shane Jones has a book on there that's cool. Yeah.
How would you describe their taste?
They are a very eclectic collective, essentially. Like I think that they run the gamut between like doing very like traditional straight-laced fiction, but they also have always had an interest in things that have a little bit of an edge and a twist to them. Like it's not necessarily formally all the time, although clearly in the case of today's thing, you know, some of their stuff is very formally intended, but a lot more. And I think that they have like an attitude that I think really fits in with like a punk rock DIY aesthetic, which makes a lot of sense with they're from Columbus, Ohio, because that's a town where that lives and breathes. Yeah.
Yeah. Columbus has a really good reputation, and honestly, Hanif Abdurraqib and this $2 Radio are like two of the contenders for why, but also the music scene I've heard is really fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got a lot of good stuff coming out of Columbus. Always has. Yeah.
Did you see all those memes about like the intro to Midwest punk?
Oh, yeah.
Were you seeing those about, like, just, like, voice recordings of, like, people, and then, like, a slow guitar?
Yeah, exactly. Just people, you know, people having like breakdowns, and then it's just the American football riff under them or something. Yeah, like yeah.
Anyway, so I will explain what this novel is about after I get Ben's first impressions on the parts that I sent him.
Yeah.
So let me explain first the parts only that I sent you, and then I'll ask you for your impressions. The parts that I sent Ben were collections of facts. So usually 3 to 4 bullet points throughout the course of the novel. I left the page numbers on, so it's like, I think typically like every like 20, 30 pages, there will be a page that's just collections of facts.
Yeah.
This is a 284-page novel, and I think I sent you like 20 pages of facts with 3 to 4 facts per page.
Yeah, yeah. About 30, actually, yeah.
Oh, 30 pages. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool, cool, cool. So, Ben, what do you think about the facts?
Well, I think this is a really interesting, like, kind of feminist medical analysis is something that I think is going on here a lot. There's a lot of references to, like, our you know, people and how they've understood the menstrual cycle and the medical intervention that has occurred in relation to that a lot, as well as just women's health in general, things having to do with pregnancy, I believe. And also, like, specifically just, you know, facts relating to women in the workplace and just kind of this feminist analysis of, you know, various aspects of life. But with the ones that's really stood out to me are the ones that do have that medicalized center. I saw a lot of that going on. There's an interesting amount of, like, etymology that's mixed in there sometimes. Mm-hmm. You'll get a little bit of that. Something that I also, like, felt about this is, like you said, this happens every 20 to 30 pages, it seems like. And what I noted about that, like, is that it really feels like these were written one right after another. Like, these, each one flows into the next one really nicely. Like, I think that there's, you know, you can feel the theme moving through each of these, like, little sections, like, from one to one. It was a lot of really interesting stuff, a lot of stuff I did not know. Like, we have on page 199 the amazing, like, almost terrifying fact, babies cry before they are born, which is, like, so scary. Like, yeah.
That's so scary. Yeah. That's really scary. I don't like that.
Yeah. and a lot of it kind of has this tinge of, like, terror around it, around, like, around women's bodies and the way that those bodies are treated. Like, very interesting stuff. That's a lot of what I gleaned off of these. So, yeah, what do you think? Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, and something else just about the facts. I love that you feel like the theme is continued or, like, elaborated or naturally wanders between the different pages that I sent. I kind of think that they're sometimes pretty disparate if you skip them, if you skip around in it, right? Like, 212... One of the facts on 212 is whenever a piece of rope is knotted, it is weakened. And then just a couple sections forward, 229. The word adultery derives from the French avolt, which evolved from the Latin verb adulterare, meaning to corrupt. Yeah, you have to kind of squint to see the thread between these, right?
Yeah.
You have to, like, be willing to go with a lot without a lot of context. So this novel, I picked it up. I was in Boulder entertaining myself for a morning after giving a friend a ride, and I stumbled into a bookstore and indie publisher based in Boulder, Colorado, Trident Publishing, and Trident Bookstore, which also has a coffee shop, by the way, if you're ever in Boulder, Colorado, worth a stop. Stumbled into this book there. They also have great poetry taste. This novel uses, formally, structurally, it's pretty, like, more conventional, straightforward storytelling to visions sections and then interspersed with these facts throughout. So what happens in this novel, I think it's generally described as, like, surrealist. It's horror-influenced, but I don't find it horrific. It won a Shirley Jackson, an award named after Shirley Jackson, so it's definitely horror inspired at the very least. What happens in this novel, so the main character, the narrator, is born with a knot in her chest. So she's like, just take this as literal. Like, she's got a torso, a knot, or like her body is twisted into a knot, and then like lower body normal.
Okay, yeah.
And it's hereditary. All of the women in her family have this knot in them.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And the novel follows her from childhood through adulthood. Her childhood, she grew up on a meat farm. I thought that you would freaking flip over this part. It is literally good. Like a quarry where they go and they mine and harvest meat from the ground.
Good, good, yes.
I've literally read this and I thought, this is Ben Grimm's. He's gonna get this job. They describe like the smell of the meat in the farm.
Oh, cool.
It's got like a, it starts with her family relationships. Her mom is like making her diet in a way that she doesn't like. Her mom is like trying to keep her up with fashion and keep her like publicly, like the common version of hot, which is impossible because of the knot, the like unusual formation of her body. She goes to school. She has a crush on a best friend, or like has a crush on a boy. Is raped by the boy, goes off to work as a secretary in town, retreats to buying a home in the mountains. Her dad, who she always really loved, dies. There's grief. And then I don't even, this is a book where I don't remember the ending, honestly, you know, where it's not really about the plot for me.
Yeah. Clearly. Yeah.
It's really not about the plot. But what it's interspersed throughout with these fact sections, which I really loved as formally because I haven't seen facts used like this in fiction. We see this in lyrical essays sometimes where it's just like three random facts. Let's keep going with the plot of the essay. But we hold up the plot to have these weird facts interspersed. And I think these facts like really further reveal the psychology of the narrator. So what is she thinking about? What is she researching? While growing up. So this begins, the 30 pages worth of facts that I sent you, begins with her in like elementary school. And she has a period for the first time is why she's looking this up. And she grows up through the course of the kinds of facts that she's researching. By the end, she's researching facts about grief, about her because of her dad dying.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. Well, that's interesting because it's like I was saying, like, I could kind of read a narrative onto these facts. Like, when you first sent this to me, I thought that this was what the entire book was just going to be, like, sections like these. Like, and I thought you had just sent me these, like, at not necessarily at random, like, but that it was like, here's this, and it's like, because, like, it does reveal a narrative between these things of how it moves from, like, thoughts on, you know, a woman's body into thoughts of love, thoughts of death and grief. Like, they kind of flow between each other in that way. And knowing that there is a narrative informing that all, like, so of course that makes sense. Like, and it's really interesting knowing now that's, like, if you strip away the actual narrative, like, its echoes still maintain in these sections. That's really cool. Like,
This book... like Roxane Gay reviewed this as like revealing what it's like to be a woman, like various trials typical to straight women in particular, or women who date men in particular. And if we're just looking at the facts, I think it also reveals how much narrower her interest becomes. Like when she's in elementary, at the beginning when she's in elementary school, the first few facts are about like octopi and lions. You know, like they're very external to her. They're very like adventurous in scope. An octopus has 3 hearts, 9 brains, and blue blood. The sun will only get brighter before it collapses. And then towards, you know, it becomes about her body, about grief that she's currently experiencing, like like coping with things that she is currently going through. And I think that also reveals like how this kid's like adventurous spirit is really beat down to be like very narrow and self-focused.
Like it's you see it's interesting, like to see what is revealed as far as that goes. Like, now knowing, like, the cast that is played on something like Page 56, like mm-hmm. the way that this suddenly it's like, now I realize that these things, like, you know, late Stone Age jugs suggest that intentionally fermented drinks existed during the Neolithic period. Alcohol is a depressant, which in low doses causes euphoria. In higher doses, alcohol causes stupor, unconsciousness, or death. Like, knowing now that that relates back to this narrative, like, everything, all the things about these facts is that they also all have this super dark tinge over them. Mm-hmm. Like, even that first one from elementary school, you know, ending it on the sun will only get brighter before it collapses. Like, that's
so dark.
None of these are happy thoughts. None of these are like, pleased with anything. Like, these are all very, they're very anxious, I think, a lot of the time. Like, there's clearly a lot of anxiety in what's being expressed here. And that is then, like, you know, reflected back onto whatever narrative is occurring. Like, it's really interesting.
That's a super interesting one. That alcohol one in particular is right mm-hmm. after her dad is an alcoholic, and that section comes right and that section comes right after, in order to impress her best friend, she steals alcohol and they get drunk on the farm and, like,
mm-hmm.
cause destruction of property while drunk. So she's, like, searching for facts to contextualize her life, and because she's not doing well emotionally, that's evidenced in what topics she's interested in and how she, like, frames things, where she cuts things off.
Like, that's really cool. So I guess my question is, like, so when you're why did you just bring me the fact sections? Why didn't you want me to look at the narrative in here?
I thought I wanted to see, like, how much of the, like, narrative scope you would intuit or, like, extrapolate based on just getting the facts alone. I pulled a little bit of an experiment on you. Thank you for bringing this.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Yeah, like I said, like, it's, to me, it definitely felt like there was a narrative. Even if my thoughts were that this was what the entire book was, like, it definitely feels like there is movement from each of these concepts into each other, and they relate back to each other, because, like, that, you know, like I is saying about, like, the themes of this, like, feminist critique, like, I think a way that that gets signaled, and I think a way that, like, not just here, like, I don't want to call this a trope or like a cliche or something like that, but the line, like, when you bring in female lions do 90% of the hunting for the pride, I feel like that's a piece of, like, feminist analysis that you see used over and over again. Like that's a really easy call to make out to let a reader know, like, where this book is standing in terms of that, like, political valence. And it's something that, like, you know, we see not just here, but in lots of places. That fact is used in a lot of feminist critique and as a way of, like, reorienting what we think of as female work. And that's just such it's a very powerful image to use and a very powerful idea that we as a culture always return to a lot. And that, like, allows that sort of signaling throughout the rest of the piece. Even if that is this very early moment, we see then that's deepened and critiqued and intensified as this piece goes on in the sections that you sent me.
I think it is so interesting. The sections that I sent you are, like, one sentence facts, like, throughout. And I love that you're picking up, like, you're using terms like critique and analysis when talking about them. Like, I think it's so true that just, like, selection of facts creates an argument, right? Like, selection is a argument in itself, even if she's not adding opinionated takes on these facts. Like, choosing the selection of facts is building an argument.
What you choose to present, what you choose to talk about is where argument begins, right? Like, any point you're going to make always begins with like these faculties, and then criticism is what's attached to that. Like,
I think often about when I briefly was, you know, studying and then trying to be a journalist, I thought often about types of bias, and people are pretty relatively quick to pick up on if a journalist has, like, overt bias about the subject matter. But what people don't pick up on quickly is if a journalist has coverage bias. So what is newsworthy? What gets included in the news versus what do we say that's not worth writing a news article about? That is not news per se. Yeah. So I think it's like, you know, like this is coverage bias. Like even if it's not providing a take, like choosing what to cover indicates bias.
That is what becomes the news is in itself, you know, like what is presented on. Like you see that in strategy all the time, like with how people choose what aspects of Gaza to cover right now. It like what how that's presented.
That was on my mind
like,
as well. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's on everyone's mind right now. It's always going to come in. That's just the case, like in how that sort of thing is presented. Yeah.
Yeah. And I wanted to contrast the like writing style of the facts versus I'd like to read like a quick section from
Please.
The prose section.
Yeah, I'd love that. Yeah.
So the section I'm going to tell you the two like pages of facts that this comes between.
Okay.
This prose section I'm going to quote from page 44.
Mm-hmm.
So on page 40, there's a selection of facts about kissing. Mm-hmm. 2/3 of people tilt their head towards the right when they kiss rather than the left. Mm-hmm. No two lip prints are the same. And then after this section on page 48, the selection of facts is about uteruses. Like she goes to what happens in between this includes that she has like sex education class at school for the first time. And the uterus facts are like, the uterus is roughly the shape and size of a small pear. It is the only organ that can create an entire other organ. During pregnancy, the placenta is grown inside the uterus. So in between those facts, here's some of the prose that gets us there. This is about, in part, the diet that her mother has her on includes sucking on rocks instead of eating food.
Great.
It's a surrealist novel. Yeah. Really good.
Yeah.
Really effective.
Sure worked.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, so she just literally sucks rocks. Big rock. Puts her mouth on it. I know.
Getting sloppy on the stone.
In the crowded lunchroom, plastic chairs scrape the floor. The mouths of my classmate open and sandwiches slide in. Jared, the boy she has a crush on, eats a peach. The long strings hang from his lips, the deep color of the pit and the blood of the fruit. I hunger for a peach, a cake, a meat. I feed myself the future instead. Slender, cheekbones sharp, mouth pursed, thin thighs, thin arms. I slide the rock into my mouth. I love the prose in this.
Yeah. That's nice. That's a tasty little section right there.
The morsel.
The strings on the peach. That's good. Like, I like that. Yeah.
I feed myself the future instead.
Yeah.
Description of her post-diet vision of a body.
Yeah.
I feed myself the future instead. That's delish.
Yeah, that's great. That's just one of those great things. Like, you know, that to me is just like on that note. Like when I read books, like, or when I just engage with art in general, I try to think about things. It's like, what are things that this form can do that other things can't do? What can movies do that nothing else can do? That's one of those things that feels like written prose, you can only get that. You can only turn time into food in written prose. That's unique to books. Nothing else can do that. Like, and that's what makes these things fucking special. Moments like that. Like,
100%. Interiority, and then just like moving concepts literal between like literal and metaphorical concepts like that is just gorgeous.
That's a book. That's a book right there. When the metaphysical and the physical can shake hands in the same sentence, like that's writing. Like that's, you can't get that elsewhere. That's sick.
It's wicked. So I think that like the contrast in writing style between the prose sections and these facts is like really fascinating for me. I think it's in part, you know, I've talked with non-writer friends, like how, when they write things, how they write is just not how they talk. Like our non-writer friends, like when they're writing a list, when they're like writing down an explanation, like whatever the case may be, they tend to just be more formal and like less voicey, less interior than when they're like telling a story out loud to me. And I don't know, I think that helps characterize this character for me further. Like, I view these lists as like something that she is writing, like the topics that she's exploring, journals that she's writing to herself. This, it's never contextualized like what these facts are. We just kind of like have to pick it up and figure it out as we go.
Yeah.
But it further characterizes her for me as like someone who isn't like necessarily writing her own story or begging to be understood. We're just going on this journey and like in her head, and this is that's how she thinks she thinks, you know? Yeah. That's how she organizes her thoughts is facts that she's discovered recently.
Yeah. That's interesting. So like that's an interesting, especially to take that on, is that these lists are the actions of a character within the story. Like, what is there anything that made you jump to that, rather than them just being like thematic overtures? Like, which, what made you?
I think feel more that? Thematic overtures. Yeah. It's, they generally just struck me as like things in this moment that she, given what's going on, would be likely to want to look up and figure out.
Yeah. That's interesting. Like, I just feel like I, as a reader, when I would encounter that, like, to me, it would always be like that would be like these are separate. Like I would see that as like extant written commentary within the book itself, like rather than something like directly involved in the narrative. But like I totally see, like I think that your explanation of it being from the narrative is just as legitimate and makes as much sense as anything else. Like
I view them. I mean, the facts are like third person. Objective tone. And then the prose sections are like first person narrator. So I view them as just part of the first person narrator. But you're saying you view the facts as like context for the first person narrator, not necessarily from her.
Yeah, that's I think that's how they would end up reading to me. And I don't know. That might just be because I've only read them. Like, I haven't read them within the full context, and that might just be, you know, of course it would make feel that way if I did, but, like, I don't know, I just think that's interesting, like, the way that you're approaching that, that's cool, yeah.
I mean, both are super interesting options. Super interesting tools for writers to consider, like, is this something that further explores this character, is this part of her, or is this from a different voice, or from the writer, in just context to better understand what's happening in the prose.
Yeah, because both still would like involve the character. Like either way, whether it's commentary from outer or action from within, like both still like I think can accomplish that goal of adding this like, you know, deeper insight into what's going on at the end of the day. Like that's, you know, what we're getting out of prose in general at a certain point. Like I wonder, it's like it makes me wonder on the intention of the writer there of like, well, what the goal is with those sections, if they are action of like, and I also think about it, how when I'm writing something like this, like it wouldn't even occur to me necessarily to have a moment like that come from inside the character. But it feels like if you do think of it that way, like it's going to make the whole thing sing a lot louder. Like, and it's going to because that's, it's cohesion where I see like separate strands. Instead, it creates a cohesive whole. Like,
You know, I think that just aligns with, we've talked before. I think of my writing as very character driven, and you think of your writing as very concept driven.
Yeah.
And I think that just like our difference in how we interpreted this is just a perfectly aligning
with you
like furthering the concept and me furthering the character.
Yeah, exactly. But that's cool because it just shows that those things are at the end of the day, like they're trying to be the same thing, right? Like
in a really good book, they are completely inseparable.
Yeah, exactly. Like when you do it correctly, you can't tell if it's one or the other. It's just there. Like,
Juicy. Juicy.
Like that peach.
Stringy. Speaking of how you would do it if you were to do it, I want to talk about turning this into a writing exercise. So,
yes, please.
What are some other ways that you think this tool of just bringing in facts to fiction can be used.
Okay, interesting.
I think I've stumped you. Okay, let me do a pre-question, an easier one, and then let that one
load
for a
second. Then we can go into that, yeah.
Do you agree with me that bringing in facts into fiction is pretty rare?
Interesting. Like, I was just thinking about that, and it's like, my knee-jerk would to say, like, no, of course not. Everything has to be informed by facts, but it's like, that's not the same thing as bringing facts into fiction. Like, right. Using actual, like, you know, for lack of a better term, like, trivia. Like,
yeah,
you know,
that's
like
the word I was thinking of too.
Yeah, like within something is pretty rare beyond like an occasional flourish, right? Like you get like what comes to mind are like Murakami and his Beatles references. Like that's a version of it that you might see. But like that's, you know, that's occasional. That's just like a signet that's a flourish for him. That's not what he's trying to do by any means. Like having it be centralized is really rare. You're right. Like
I think it's often used like factual world building, historical fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, my favorite novel is The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay, and that absolutely, she has done a phenomenal amount of historical research to write that novel. But it's not like tangential facts that I see facts often in building an accurate and full and robust world, but not like in tangential further exploring a concept or further exploring a character's psychology. I can't think of anything else top of mind.
Yeah, me either. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, given that it's almost never freaking done, why not? It's so cool here.
Yeah, exactly. So my question is, like, would we want people to just, like, literally just try to do the same thing of, like, having these sidelong sections in this same way? Or is there another way to, like, bring this sort of thing in, like, to have it participate in the fiction? Yeah,
well, you know, I'm character driven, so my answer is going to be a character driven answer. I think, like, something that I absolutely do is just, like, I'm on a Wikipedia spiral, like, further contextualizing something that's happening in my real life. I think I'm not alone in my Wikipedia spiraling, right? I'm not alone in my, like, deep googling of and I think that that's not represented in fiction well today. Like, what's on this character's mind, whether it's like made physical in the real world or not, is just, I think, a really rich and underexplored area of characterization. So what is this character's search history like compared to another's?
That's really true. That's a good point. Like, bringing in those sort of things that, like, we all do have this kind of, like, trail of facts that we're looking up kind of, like, behind us in a physical way in our search histories. Like you're saying, very literally, I think that's, like, an interesting thing to bring in. Like that the idea of revealing that or utilizing that as a way of, like, describing a character's mood or something like that. Like,
Or, like, how they're interpreting events around them, too. Like, the section on, I think your, like, lioness example is, like, so strong because she's really just forming for the first time, like, understanding of what it means that she's female compared to her older brother who's going to inherit the meat farm, even though she's as good as him at doing the meat farm stuff. Yeah, so, like, even an elementary school level of, like, starting to realize what it means to be female, like, can be represented through slant, in a slant way. Yeah. We just were anti-slant, but now I'm back on pro-slant.
but that's so strange for this to feel, like, pro-slant, because it's literally saying facts. Like, it's literally, like, is there a more direct way to talk about something? I don't know if there is. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, because I think the difference here is, like, these facts are, like, in addition to, further contextualizing the prose. So, like, the example about, like, facts about kissing, and then in the prose section, she's dieting and she goes to sex ed class in elementary school, and then a series of facts about the uterus. Like, this is clearly her understanding her body and her sexuality, right? Yeah. And it's, we already get that, and we just get these facts as bonus and additional mood setters. Yeah, so I think steal this format one for one, or consider like, what are your, what's your Wikipedia search history like? What fact spirals have you got on recently? As a way to like further explore character psychology. Any other ideas, Ben?
Yeah, well, I think just like even like just furthering on that, like, you know, what is your character like? What is their search history is like? What do they know? You know, like, what do they know about? Like, well, how does that inform who they are? Like, just because, like, you know, I think in some ways, like, I know this is probably true into the past as well, but it feels like a very 21st century thing, the way that we build our personalities around, like, knowledge codexes, essentially, like, through things like being fans of stuff, you know, like knowing a bunch about Marvel comics or knowing a bunch about a certain band or things. Like, people derive personal meaning and in self-interpretation through that, like, literally just knowledge, like literally just like stacks of information that they have, like, and that informs us in a really big way. Yeah, like, just like, so understanding what your character is into, what do they know, what do they like, what do they not like, what does that inform them of, what do they research that they're scared of, like, yeah.
Do you feel like there was a fact you can name that like changed your worldview?
Ooh.
Anything top of mind?
Like, nothing jumps out immediately. Do you have something like that? Like,
I feel like probably a million of them, and I can't think of them top of mind.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, like, I can think specifically in corpuses, right? Like, I can be, like, my something that changed and informed who I am is my knowledge of heavy metal music. Like, that's very important to me. That's part of my identity. I know for a fact that is. Like, my interest in avant-garde art is one of those things also. And the knowledge I hold therein is, like, you know, personally creating that sort of thing. But I can't specifically spit out, like, oh, there's this one thing. Like, yeah.
I can, and I said it earlier in this episode. The concept of coverage bias.
Okay.
Like, that changed my understanding. Like, understanding, like, sometimes I am looking at facts that are accurate, but I'm still not looking at the whole picture. Like,
yeah.
That was really a before and after in how I think about the world.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. This is an underexplored way to develop a character or to develop a concept.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Like, yeah, think about the knowledge that's being held, right? Like, what's the information that a person has access to, and what does it mean about them? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And how does it reveal their attitudes towards those things? Even in the case of, like, the lionesses do 90% of the hunting, that fact decontextualized implies an argument.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And it always will. Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
And that's The Book of X by Sarah Rose Eder.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts on this book or on the sections of this book I sent you?
I'm going to read it. That's my thoughts. I'm going to go order a copy at work tomorrow and then go read it. So this is exciting. Yeah.
Wicked. Supporting $2 radio.
Yeah, exactly. Continuance.
I wonder, do they ever, like, follow up on their... Do they still do the tattoo thing?
I don't know if they do. There's a picture of my chest on their website, so if you want to be weird and go look at my chest, you can see it there.
I wonder if I've seen it on their website.
Like, when I was 19. let's see if that's still up, if the tattoo club is still a thing. Let's see. $2 radio. Tattoo club. Let's see. Yep, yeah, it's still on their website. Like, yeah. Yeah. I'm gonna find it. Hold on. Sean Mitchell.
Oh, it's like first and last name.
Oh, man, they actually don't have me on here, which is kind of odd. I guess they grew tired of me.
Yes, they do, and your face is on it, too.
Oh, Benjamin, is it Kearns, really? 2015. Oh, it's Benjamin. Okay. Yep, that's me. 2015. Young-ass me. goddamn.
You're such a baby.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, if you want to see a very youthful picture of me, like
I don't
in a
know
tattoo
what you
shop
like
that's no longer
beard.
Open. Well, not like that, because I weigh a lot more now, but, yeah.
Do you? I haven't seen you in person in 4 years. That's wild.
Yeah. Well, I just mean generally. I've definitely weigh more than I did in 2015, but yeah.
I should hope so.
Yeah.
I should hope so. Those are good years.
Yeah.
That's so crazy that it's first and last name and your face is in this photo.
Yeah,
like, do you ever
that
get the
is
questions
wild.
About this? Like, in job
no.
interviews? Like,
no, it's never once come up. Like, if...
You look kind of like Robert Pattinson in this photo.
Oh, stop it. Pshaw.
Like your
very
eyes.
Very sweet
like
thing to say.
The look.
Yeah. I look like Edward Cullen. Goddamn.
A little
okay,
bit, yeah.
I'll take it. Yeah.
A little bit, yeah. I said what I said.
Thank you. But yeah, that's so funny to see that. God, I haven't thought. Like, I see this tattoo every day of my life, and I really haven't thought about the fact that that picture is on the internet.
And that's endorsement right there.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
endorsement.
Is. Yeah. And I stand by it because they're a great publisher. But yeah.
Yeah, they seem great. They seem great. Did you watch that documentary about Pepe the Frog?
Yes, Feels Good Mad. Yeah.
Feels Good Mad. Yeah. That scene where that one of his best friends before all that happened got a tattoo of Pepe.
Yeah.
And then all that happened to Pepe.
Yeah, dude. It sucks, man.
Pepe got like, oh god, what is the got Wait, taken over and became a symbol
yeah.
of white nationalists.
Yeah.
This like cartoon character, this cartoonist's character.
Yeah. They're just this frog. This frog, like, and that guy was such a nice guy. That if you have not seen the movie Feels Good Man, like, definitely check that out. Like, it's a really well done documentary about kind of about the way that symbols operate is what I would
yeah.
say it's about, and the way that, like, you know, that the sign and the signifier truly are not attached to one another, and that meaning
correct.
Is made somewhere between them. Like, yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah,
correct. And really about, like, Matt Fury the cartoonist fundamentally
yeah.
not understanding the culture of internet, like enjoying taking something from someone, like him
yeah.
trying to take back and save Pepe, and just that only
yeah.
fueling more Pepe
exactly.
turning into white nationalism.
Yeah, even though, like, I don't know, like, as someone who it poisons his brain by paying attention to far-right online spaces sometimes, just to see what's going on over there, that, like, Pepe is out. There's a new horrible frog that they love called Groiper.
Why?
That's the new guy. They love Groiper now. They can't get enough of these Groipers.
Okay, Googling. Hang on.
Yeah, it's like
G-R-O-I-P.
It might be O-I. I'm not sure.
Oh, I already dislike this.
Yeah, he's...
A group
he's...
of white nationalists and far-right activists... Provocateurs. Ugh, is there anything worse than a provocateur?
Yeah, if you call yourself a provocateur, it gulag. I'm sorry. Like, no good. Like, yeah.
Anyway, I brought it up to say I feel pretty safe about the $2 radio logo
yeah.
remaining. It's
yeah.
with its original intent.
Yeah. Yeah, I hopefully this will that they will not be taken over by some horrible conglomerate, and it's like
okay,
sorry, we publish Ben Shapiro now. Like, yeah, I don't think that's gonna happen. Like, yeah,
no, I have some faith in their taste.
Yeah,
remaining relatively clean. They're not clean, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
not
yeah,
anti-Nazi
nationalist. Yeah,
not Nazis. I think
yeah,
they will
exactly.
continue to be actively anti-Nazi.
Yeah, exactly. They'll stay cool.
Yeah.
But yeah,
cool.
Before we go,
use facts more.
Yes, use facts more. Before we go, do you have a recommendation that you want to share?
Oh, yes. I read a book. So a while ago, you recommended a BJ. No, oh my gosh.
B.R. Yeager.
Thank you.
Yeah.
B.R. Yeager.
Yeah.
B.R. Yeager's new story collection, which also intersperses, it has weird form and intersperses images, and it's just a hybrid collection.
Yeah.
It was cool. I've been thinking more about hybrid collections, and I'm trying to find the name of this. Claudia Rankine, in 2004, published a hybrid essay/poetry collection that I thought was really interesting, and I've been thinking of, it's like post 9/11, and also about like TV and depression and medicine, like pharmaceutical prescription advertisements. I just think it was good. It's called Don't Let Me Be Lonely by Claudia Rankine from 2004. Don't Let Me Be Lonely. And if you're in the mood for something hybrid, try this out.
Yeah, I really love Citizen by her. That one's really cool. That's her big famous one. I'll definitely check that out.
Cool. What about you? What's your recommendation of the episode?
I would recommend there's a musical artist named Louis Zong, who I've been listening to a lot lately. Really cool, like synthesizer-based sort of jazz fusion-inspired stuff. He's super prolific. Everything he's done is on Spotify, so you can just check it out there or on his Bandcamp. But really fun, upbeat, like kind of crazy, like almost like video game soundtrack inspired stuff too. Like he has, his newest album is called Rat Taxi, and it's about the idea of what if you were a rat that drove a taxi. And it's incredibly cool. Like it has no right to be as good as it is. Like some of the absolutely funky bass solos that this man pulls out on there are just sublime. It's so good.
Sweet.
Highly recommend that Rat Taxi. Check that out. Yeah.
Sweet. I will. I just Googled him, and he's described as cartoon funk.
That's very accurate.
That sounds so fun. Yeah, I'm in. That sounds like a great time.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right. That's great. Cool. But yeah. Thank you, everybody,
for tuning in to this episode of the Good Writing Podcast.
Yes.
We have a Twitter account if you want to find us on it, or we have an email address. Our Twitter account is Good Writing Pod, right?
Yes.
That's our Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah, Good Writing Pod is our Twitter if you want to find us there, or our email address is goodwritingpodcast@gmail.com. We got listener mail, and it made us very happy.
Yes, we did. Yeah, thank you very much to everybody who's been reaching out. A few people have reached out recently within the past couple of months, and it's been very nice to hear from you all. Thank you.
Yeah, and we're here in part, I don't know, it didn't hurt. It helped me be like, we should probably do something.
Yeah, exactly.
We're free.
That is how it made me feel. It's like, wait. Oh, yeah, people are listening. Okay.
I have no idea. There's people on this podcast. Thank you for tuning in. We'll be in your podcast feed one day again.
Yeah. Until then, keep the faith strong and your heels wet. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Don't worry about it.